This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. And I want to start today by sharing some tweets I got yesterday after we asked our listeners and our audience to tell us how they were faring on the island of Puerto Rico after Maria. So this is from Tara. She says, my father passed away on day 40 after Maria hit Puerto Rico. We knew the post-hurricane conditions could kill him. Unfortunately, we were right. Amanda sent us this tweet. I have friends who have committed to regularly providing meals in Aguadilla. People there are still struggling. I have friends who live in Trujillo Alto that have resumed normal life. We want to hear from our listeners. We want to hear from you about your stories, about life after Maria. And if you want to share your stories, you can tweet me at Tanzina Vega. You can tweet us at The Takeaway. And turning to today, from hospitals to medical facilities to treatment and Medicaid, Puerto Rico's public health system was failing well before Hurricane Maria ravaged the island. We're going to take a look at those failings and how a lack of funding and planning, plus the remnants of a Category 5 hurricane, has Puerto Rico's health system heading towards collapse. A study commissioned by Harvard estimated 4,645 storm-related deaths. Just to repeat that, 4,645 storm-related deaths on the island after Maria. What role, we'd like to know, has the island's failing healthcare system played in that? An investigation by the Puerto Rico Center for Investigative Journalism has actually uncovered systemic infrastructure problems dating back at least a decade before the storm. Problems like irregular Department of Healthcare inspections at nearly 400 institutions and the total lack of any comprehensive emergency response plan, which crippled facilities and responses in the storm's aftermath. Omaya Sosa is co-founder of Puerto Rico Center for Investigative Journalism, and she joins me now. Hi, Omaya.
Thank you for having me, Tansina.
So tell me, what was the state of the healthcare system on the island of Puerto Rico prior to Hurricane Maria's arrival, and particularly in some of the more remote parts of the island?
Well, the healthcare system was having problems for a long time now, for decades. Way back in the 70s, we used to have a model healthcare, public healthcare system, and it deteriorated for many reasons. It also got very costly, and the government started privatizing all the system in the 90s. After the privatization of the facilities, we ended up with just one major public hospital in San Juan. So, you know, it's a theme of a lack of resources. It's a theme of a negligence also. And, you know, it's a theme of federal funding.
And let's talk about the impact that this lack of funding has had. We know it impacted folks pre-Maria, post-Maria. How was the infrastructure hit? Your reporting also includes the story of Gaspar Cruz Agosto. I'm wondering if you could give us a sense of what happened with him.
Before the hurricane, as I said, the hospitals were in dire situation. But after the hurricane struck, many of them lost power. Hospitals like the one where Mr. Gaspar ended up in Humacao, the town of Humacao, lost the generators. It was a total mess. All the patients had to be brought down to the common areas in the emergency room, for example, and it continued. The breakdown of the system in the hospital continued so fast that in the end, they had to close down the hospital and transfer all the patients to other institutions that were also pretty bad, maybe not as bad as that one, but certainly were pretty bad. So this happened in the weeks and months after the hurricane. All over the island, generators breaking down in the middle of a surgery, patients being transferred from one broken hospital to another one that was hanging on a thread and that would break down too. So that's the process in which many people got caught and sadly died.
Now, yesterday, earlier this week, we've seen numbers from a Harvard study that brings the death toll of Puerto Ricans after Maria upwards of 4,500 lives or 4,600 lives. Is there any way to track those deaths or percentage of those deaths back to the systemic failings in the healthcare system?
There is, and there should be. I think people have to be clear that the Harvard study is projection. It's not a case by case. It's not that they have 4,600 names of people that died. It's something the government should have done. They do have the resources to do this.
Now, do we know that what specific populations were affected by this breakdown more than others? Were the elderly affected more? Were rural populations affected more by this? Or is it still too early to tell?
Yes, we do. At least at the Center for Investigative Journalism in Puerto Rico, from this sample we have, and we are doing this second phase of our investigation with the assistance of public health experts. We get some trends that are quite consistent in terms of demographics. For example, the median age is 75 years old. Like Harvard, their study says that 30% of the cases they are estimating were due to delayed or interrupted healthcare services. We are finding that more than 60% of the cases we have documented are of people that died either in a healthcare facility or an elderly home that here are considered also healthcare facilities. So it may be even higher, the cost and effect of the breakdown of the healthcare system, than what Harvard is saying.
Omaya, who is responsible for this? And I know that's probably a loaded and difficult question, but the truth is, Puerto Ricans are American citizens, whether they're on the island or on the mainland. Does the U.S. federal government have any oversight in what is happening here?
I mean, we cannot erase the fact that the hurricane was devastating. It was something we have not seen ever. It's a historical phenomenon. It's the first time that a hurricane basically destroys the whole island at once in 24 hours, so there was nowhere to go. It's not like the South was spared and you could take patients to the South and so forth. So, you know, that's a reality. But the days after, and the weeks after, I think the response was so slow that a lot of these deaths really could have been prevented. Seeing spikes of death a month after, 2 months after, that really is unacceptable. And I think the local Puerto Rican government and the federal government both are much to blame for this. They were not prepared. They didn't have a public health emergency plan. The federal government also didn't assign the resources they should have, and they would have assigned to any state, because I'm sure this would not have not happened in any of the 50 states. And then in the end, it's a problem of what you're saying, who is to blame? Well, we are a colony. And since we are a colony, and that for me is one of the most outrageous things of the whole situation in the 21st century, the U.S. still holds a colony. We cannot hold accountable any of the governments. The U.S. blames the Puerto Rican government, and the Puerto Rican government blames the U.S. government. So, you know, it's a very difficult situation. And I think this hurricane exposed what are the real problems and challenges of having this political status we have here in Puerto Rico.
Omaya Sosa is co-founder of Puerto Rico Center for Investigative Journalism. Omaya, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Tani.
Puerto Rico was facing a major Medicaid funding crisis since before Hurricane Maria made landfall. And now, after the storm, close to 1 million people are at risk for losing their coverage. Medicaid is the main source of insurance coverage for low-income families, pregnant women, children, and people with disabilities, and about half of Puerto Rico's 3.4 million residents receive Medicaid. But because the island is a U.S. territory and not a state, it doesn't get the same federal support that states do, which means that Puerto Rico is at a higher risk for losing coverage and forcing an overhaul of their system. Carmen Heredia Rodriguez is a reporter for Kaiser Health News who's been tracking this. Carmen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us, how does the U.S. government allocate Medicaid funding in Puerto Rico versus the United States? Why does it treat it differently?
Sure. So like the states here on the mainland, the federal government and the island's government both contribute to funding Medicaid. But there are a couple of key differences on the island versus a state here on the mainland. The biggest difference is the fact that Puerto Rico has to work with capped funding from the federal government. So in a state, they can essentially access money from the federal government on an open-ended basis, so there's no cap. Whereas in Puerto Rico, there is a cap to the amount of federal funding that they get. So prior to Hurricane Maria, the Puerto Rican government actually got an allotment from the Affordable Care Act to the tune of $6.3 billion that was supposed to last until September 2019. However, even before the hurricane, island officials were saying that this money was going to run out at the end of 2017. So this island has gotten more money thanks to recovery money that has come in from Congress due to Hurricane Maria. But ultimately, this doesn't change the mechanism that they're funded through.
And how does the Puerto Rican government, how have they been covering the costs both pre and post Maria?
essentially it's been coming out of their own pockets. So as we see with the fiscal crisis that they have, they've taken out loans, they've tried doing bonds, they've done virtually everything in their power in order to cover their expenses, and that includes Medicaid.
And the Puerto Rican government, as we mentioned, is planning a Medicaid overhaul. Tell me about what those expectations are, particularly as so many people are at risk to lose their Medicaid coverage.
Sure. So right now, the island is divided into 9 different regions. 8 of them are geographic, and 1 of them serves as a virtual network. And so the insurers on the island are responsible for providing coverage to folks in their particular regions, or regions as they're assigned. Now, officials say that the system has become problematic because it traps people in their regions that may be a location that may or may not have the services that they need. So what they're going to do is turn it into a one-region system where these insurers will have to compete for different beneficiaries across the island. And what island officials are saying is that this will improve the network that people are able to access, because these insurers will have to provide island-wide access rather than just a region. And it'll also improve competition.
Now, is this similar to, and I'm thinking about insurance companies having to compete, is this similar to Obamacare, or is it a different model?
So Puerto Rico is unique in a lot of ways, particularly in their Medicaid program, because they're all managed care organizations, which means that the insurers pool their people together and then pay doctors a set amount of money per patient, regardless of what services they may or may not provide. And this has become problematic on the island because the population is declining due to immigration, and the people that are being left behind are actually a lot sicker and a lot older.
And so tell us about the impact that this change could have. I mean, I've got relatives on the island who, I can tell you, it's difficult to get around the island if you need medical care and you're old and not well. So what impact could this have? Is this better for patients?
So the impact that it'll have on beneficiaries remains to be seen. So ACCESS officials, which is the healthcare administration, so these officials say that beneficiaries will be able to continue their services without any interruptions during this transition. Beneficiaries will also have a period of time where they can change their insurer if they're like between October 1st and December 1st, and then these permanent changes will go into effect January 1st. However, community health centers and physician groups are a little skeptical about how this transition will actually happen. There are a lot of unanswered questions. One of them is, how will the beneficiaries be assigned to the insurers when October 1st comes around? So the island is saying that they're going to auto-assign beneficiaries to particular insurers, but people are worried because they don't want to lose patients, right? I mean, if they lose patients, they lose money. Another question that they have is, how much will the Medicaid program pay per patient for medical services? And will that be enough, right? So there's a physician shortage, and there's also a fiscal crisis, so physicians want to be paid. And if that per member amount drops, we may have another exodus of physicians on our hands.
Carmen Heredia Rodriguez is a reporter for Kaiser Health News. Carmen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
He felt around by moving his fingers around inside for a few minutes. He said that this was part of an STD test. He didn't use a speculum or any other medical tools. He then stuck the swab into me and smiled. He then put it in a vial and said that we were done. At the time, he made me feel extremely uncomfortable and violated.
That's Daniela Moazzab, a master's student at the University of Southern California. At a press conference on May 22nd, Moazzab recounted a 2016 visit to Dr. George Tyndall, a former USC gynecologist. She's one of more than 20 women to file suit against Tyndall and USC for Tyndall's alleged misconduct during his nearly 3-decade-long tenure with the university.
I am still in shock that USC had heard about Dr. Tyndall's inappropriate conduct and had allowed him to continue practicing. Reportedly, USC was aware of Dr. Tyndall's inappropriate conduct before I was even born.
In addition to the lawsuits, the Los Angeles Police Department is investigating more than 50 claims of misconduct by Dr. Tindall. Tindall quietly resigned last summer in a secret deal with a financial payment from USC, and an investigation by the LA Times discovered that USC officials knew about allegations against Tindall for nearly 30 years, but allowed him to continue seeing patients anyway. Harriet Ryan is an investigative reporter for the LA Times, and she's one of the journalists who broke the story. Harriet, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So bring us up to speed here. Tell us a little bit more about the allegations against George Tindall.
Well, as you mentioned, they go back three decades. He worked at the university for 27 years. During that time, he was the sole full-time gynecologist at the student health clinic. And starting in the early 90s, there were allegations against Dr. Tindall. Some of the staff members that worked at the clinic with him complained that he was taking pictures of patients' genitals in the 1990s. There were other allegations over the years about improper touching during pelvic exams and making suggestive and sometimes lewd comments about women's bodies, sometimes when his fingers were inside them.
What did the university know about Tindall, and when did they know it?
The current leaders of the university say that they didn't understand the full scope of the problem until the last couple of years. However, it's pretty clear that students and staff were going to administrators at the clinic, supervisors at the clinic, starting in the early 90s. The university has said that the executive director of the clinic, who died 2 years ago, handled many of these complaints independently. And when they went back into his files, they said they found complaints, many complaints, that in their current view would have required Dr. Tindall to leave the clinic or no longer see patients. They say they can't understand why the executive director did not take action at the time.
Okay. I have to stop there because, you know, a day, 2 days, 3 days, a handful of experiences, nearly 30 years of this happening, and no one outside of this administrator knew that this was happening at the university.
There are definitely allegations from women who say, no, I took this hire. I went to the Women's Center on campus. One woman that we interviewed said that she actually received a letter from USC apologizing for Dr. Tindall's treatment of her and saying that, you know, they were going to go back into her medical file and make some changes with comments that he'd written. But, you know, 27 years is a long time. A lot of the people that worked with him are no longer working at USC at all. Many of them are dead. And it's really hard to reconstruct who told what, when, and why it wasn't taken more seriously.
Well, I mean, this strikes me as almost, and in our introduction, we said that there was a payment at Tindall's resignation, quiet resignation last summer. Is this a culture of complicity in the university? Because we see stories like this happening time and time again of abuses that have lasted decades.
The university started a very serious investigation of Tindall in June of 2016, and pretty quickly they determined that there was validity to the complaints against him. And they ultimately found that he had performed inappropriate pelvic exams because of the use of his fingers, and that he, in essence, sexually harassed students. At this point, they wanted him out of the university, and they did like a secret deal whereby he got some kind of financial payment, and he was allowed to resign. They've said that at that time they should have reported him to the state medical board, and they didn't. After we started reporting our story this spring, they actually made a retroactive report to the state medical board about him. It does seem like it was important to them that this be handled quietly, that not a lot of people find out. The actual terms of the settlement are still secret. So complicity, I don't know, but there was definitely an emphasis on taking care of this quickly and quietly. And there wasn't focus on going back to the potentially tens of thousands of women who had seen him over the decades and saying, hey, what happened to you? Did anything strange happen at your appointment? Did you complain to anybody? And they're doing that now. And that's why, you know, more than 400 women have come forward to USC now and said, like, look, I want to talk about what happened at my appointment, whether it was in 1992 or, you know, 2 years ago.
And for our listeners just catching up, we're talking about 50 claims of misconduct against the USC former school gynecologist with Harriet Ryan, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Harriet, let's talk repercussions. There's been a lot of fallout from this, including the news that USC President Max Nikias has stepped down. Tell us about it.
there was intense pressure on the president after the revelations about Dr. Tyndall. And initially, the Board of Trustees said they were completely behind the president and they wanted him to try to fix the problem and examine what had gone wrong with Dr. Tyndall. But students started a petition to have the president resign. And then hundreds of faculty said they lost confidence in him and that he did not have the moral integrity to lead. So he stepped down. There's going to be a new president. And there's an outside investigation into how the school handled this and who knew what and whether people did the right thing at the time.
And what's next for the university and for the victims?
More than 20 women have filed lawsuits against USC for negligence in how they responded to Dr. Tyndall. And we expect that there'll be hundreds more women joining those lawsuits. In addition, as you mentioned, there's an LAPD investigation, a criminal probe that is looking at Dr. Tyndall's conduct and whether it amounts to sexual abuse or another crime. And the police have said that if they come across evidence that administrators at USC engaged in criminal behavior in how they handled him, they'll be addressing that as well.
Harriet Ryan is an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Harriet, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Hey, thanks for checking out the Takeaways podcast. Why not help spread the word? You leaving us a rating or a review on iTunes will definitely help us stand out from the pack. Thanks in advance. Now back to the show.
With the Right to Try law I'm signing today, patients with life-threatening illnesses will finally have access to experimental treatments that could improve or even cure their conditions.
That was President Trump signing the Right to Try Act. It allows terminally ill patients to seek access to experimental medications that have not yet been approved by the FDA.
These are experimental treatments and products that have shown great promise, and we weren't able to use them before. Now we can use them.
The law builds on a program that's been in place since the 1970s, sometimes called compassionate use. So what's different now, and will this new law save lives? For that, we go to Timothy Callahan, assistant professor at the Texas A&M University School of Public Health. Hey, Timothy, can you explain what this new law does?
What it does is it allows terminally ill patients the right to try experimental medications that have not yet been fully vetted by the Food and Drug Administration. So these are people who are going to be dying otherwise, and it gives them the right to try drugs that have not yet been approved.
Isn't this already in existence in some shape or form in a couple of states around the country?
So as of today, 40 states have already signed it into law. So the first state signed it into law in 2014, and since 2014, 40 of the 50 states have already signed it into law. So from that perspective, it's sort of already active in most of the states, but if you live in one of those 10 states who haven't yet done this, then it could be pretty meaningful potentially.
And does the federal government have to get involved, or should we just wait for more of the states to decide what they want to do? Why federal oversight here?
Federal oversight could be for a few different reasons. One could be quite simply because we don't know how long it's going to take in those extra 10 states. Another possibility is just the drug companies have been pretty hesitant to participate in this program. And with the federal approval of it, perhaps the drug companies might be more likely to get on board.
So there's been some reporting in the New York Times where they said that, for example, Colorado enacted the first Right to Try law in 2014. And that, in fact, there, and I'm quoting here, there have been no documented cases of anyone receiving access because of a right to try law to an experimental product that would not have already been available via the FDA's expanded access program. This is from a NYU study, a 2017 NYU study. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think the reality of this is the FDA already has a program, it's a compassionate use program that allows people to try these experimental drugs after some FDA oversight. So they have to go through a review board and a panel of experts. But once they've done that, the FDA is usually pretty willing to give out approval for these drugs. So the FDA has approved 99.4% of cases. So of the 5,849 cases reported, 5,816 of them have been approved.
And how does this law change what's already on the books?
Well, at the federal level, it basically gets rid of some of the FDA oversight of the program. So instead of having this compassionate use program, patients are hopefully going to be able to bypass some of that FDA oversight. And that's one of the reasons that many past directors of the FDA have opposed this, because they view the FDA oversight as quite important, and you're getting rid of some of that inherently with this new piece of legislation.
Does that put patients at a higher risk if things don't go as they expect?
It potentially could. I mean, you have to remember these are people who are terminally ill anyways and are looking for anything. But some of the Democratic opponents of this new piece of legislation have called it, you know, there's a potential for sort of snake oil salesmen, as one Democratic representative put it, that because you're only talking about drugs that have completed the first phase of the many phases of clinical trials, the only thing we know about these drugs is they're probably not lethal. But beyond that, we don't know if they're going to be effective or what the side effects necessarily will be.
Let's talk about the money behind this, too. I mean, I'm sure this isn't people giving out medication, experimental drugs for free. What's the role of health insurers in this? You mentioned peddling snake oil. You know, without any FDA oversight, I wonder how safe patients are and how much this is actually going to cost people.
Yeah, that's the another big piece of this, is that it could be cost prohibitive for many patients, because pharmaceutical companies are hesitant to give out the drugs, but even if they do, it's going to be quite expensive, because these are experimental drugs that are only in development, so there's not that many of them. So supply and demand, they're going to be quite expensive. And insurers are typically going to be very hesitant to pay for the drugs themselves, as well as for any side effects that are the result of these drugs. So many of these patients are potentially going to have to pay out of pocket. Now, if you have a terminal illness and this potentially allows you to live, you might be willing to pay that price, but it would be a pretty high price in most cases.
What's the solution here? I mean, is there a better solution or a better system to helping to connect people who are terminally ill with experimental drugs that may or may not save their lives without the costs that could be prohibited?
Yeah, I mean, I think the issue ultimately comes down to, like you said, the cost and the drug company's unwillingness to provide these medications. So it would almost need to be some sort of government push to provide those things, and making sure that the drug companies aren't going to have to pay out of pocket for any issues that come up as a result in trials, and also making sure that the insurers aren't necessarily footing the bill. But that would be more government oversight, which wouldn't necessarily be likely under a Trump administration.
Timothy Callahan, assistant professor at the Texas A&M University School of Public Health, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Okay, have you ever been in a position where you needed an experimental drug to save yourself or a loved one who has a terminal illness? If so, how did you navigate that process? We've already gotten several text messages from you. From Greenville, South Carolina, we got this message. When my mom had cancer, there was a drug trial we wanted to get into, but they said she was too far along. It was heartbreaking. And one from Louisville, Kentucky. My father was lucky enough to be accepted into a clinical trial of a new cancer treatment, and it's the reason he's still alive today.
Hello, this is Richard Munoz calling from Key West. Just wanted to bring up a story of my dad when he had cancer. The chemotherapy he was going through stopped working, so the only other option was experimental drug, a new chemotherapy. He took it for a while, but because it was new, I think it didn't have a lot of the medication that prevents the side effects that his other one had. So he just decided that it was his time, and he stopped taking the drug, and he died soon afterwards.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. We're rounding out the hour here on The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. It's been 25 years since the death of the Colombian drug kingpin Pablo Escobar. He was one of the wealthiest cartel leaders of all time, and he even made the Forbes list of international billionaires every year from 1987 to 1993. But his name is also synonymous with extraordinary violence. In the city of Medellin, where his cartel operated, homicides spiked to over 6,000 in 1991. Decades later, the wounds remain, but the Escobar legend still draws flocks of curious tourists to Medellin every year. And one of the key attractions? Guided visits to key sites in Escobar's life. They're called narco tours.
A lot of people are coming to the city, people from other countries, people from other cities in Colombia, and they just want to know better his story. So there are like 15 tours in the city that are taking people to different places that are related to Pablo Escobar. So we decided to do one of those to see what's the story that they're telling to the tourists that are coming to the city. And it's pretty crazy.
That's Jorge Caraballo, an engagement editor for NPR's Radio Ambulante. Caraballo was born in Medellin, and he took the tour for the rest of us.
So it costed $50. They told me go to this supermarket in a very high upper class neighborhood in the city. You will find a van. The guide will be there. So we started, and from the beginning, they were very like apologetic to Pablo Escobar. They were like glorifying him. They were telling you all the power that he got from nothing, from thin air. Like he started just stealing cars in the city, and then he became the most powerful drug dealer in the world. We visited the building where he lived with his family before hiding from the government in 1984. We went to the jail where he was, and he lived there for a year. And they were telling you, like, hey, this is the library of Pablo Escobar. Here are the books that he was reading. Or here is the furniture that he imported from England. And I was like, this cannot be true. I can't believe this.
Why did you say, oh, my God, I can't believe this is the tour?
Because, like, I was not expecting that. It was going to be, from the beginning, the guy told us, like, this will be a tour that will show you the transformation of Medellin after Pablo Escobar was killed. And I was excited by that because I thought, like, okay, this can tell me something about the city, something that I don't know. This is something important for me, right? It's a story that I want to know what happened, what actually happened. And the promise of the tour was that they were part of El Cartel de Medellin. The driver of the van was a member of the cartel. So they were going to tell you the story from the inside. And I was like, okay, let's hear. But once they started, I thought, like, no, that's something weird here. Like, when she was showing us the library, for example, these were like encyclopedias repeating one after another. They were not books that Pablo Escobar could read. Like, this was more like books that people were donating to that place. Because right now, the jail is not a jail. The jail where Pablo Escobar lived for 1 year is now an asylum for old people. So she was just showing us these buildings that were closed, that you cannot get into. And she was telling, this is what Pablo Escobar left here. So I began being very, very suspicious about what she was saying. Also, I know the story. I'm from Medellin. I grew up here in the city when Pablo Escobar was killing a lot of people, putting bombs all around the place. So I suffered that, and I've read a lot about that. So I know a little bit of the facts of what happened. And from her narrative, everything was very exaggerated, and everything was trying to make us feel passion for Pablo Escobar, admiration for Pablo Escobar, not the actual story. So, like, the tone of the tour was what made me feel like this is not right, this is not precise. And then the last stop of the tour is in the cemetery where he's buried. And when we were there, we found another narco tour. Like, I was in one van. This was one company that I paid to. But we met with another one, like 12 people, tourists with hats, with the cameras, with selfie sticks, flip-flops in the cemetery, looking at this grave. And just right next to us, there was like this family, 30 people that were crying because a member of their family has just died. So I was like, okay, so this is very offensive, right? To be here, to be glorifying a criminal and not to recognize the damage that he did to us.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Jorge Caraballo, and we're talking about narco tours and Pablo Escobar's legacy in Medellin, Colombia. Jorge, I'm curious about how the government sees Escobar's legacy and also about how Colombians themselves see it in light of these tours.
Well, there are two different attitudes towards this situation. Like, the local government is very critical against talking about Pablo Escobar and showing his life. They've been very, very aggressive against like Narcos from Netflix, for example, or to Wiz Khalifa, this rapper from the US who came to Medellin and took some photos in the building where I visit, or in the cemetery that I also visit during this narco tour, because for the local government, like, this is a way that the narrative of Pablo Escobar is still stigmatizing the society, Medellin society. But on the other side, people in Medellin, a lot of people in Medellin, still admire Pablo Escobar. And for me, that's very, very hard to understand, because he was someone who killed, like, in just 6 years, 33,000 people. 33,000 people were killed in the city between 87 and 93 because of the war that Pablo Escobar led. So why people admire him? Like, it's just a way to stereotype our society. And that's right. But when you like go to the neighborhoods, when you go to, there is a neighborhood that Pablo Escobar created, like he built it, and it has its name. It's Pablo Escobar neighborhood in Medellin. And people there admire him because for some people in the city, Pablo Escobar did good things. Like, he built houses, he gave cash, he created soccer fields, and he became like a symbol of hope for some people in the city. Like, you can get whatever you want. It doesn't matter how you do it, but you can get it. So we wanted to do this kind of tour to see what's the narrative and how Medellin can tell a different story that doesn't only critique those who admire Pablo Escobar, but also recognize all the damage that he did here.
Jorge Caraballo is an engagement editor for Radio Ambulante, who reported on narco tours in Medellin, Colombia. Jorge, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tansina.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow, you'll be joined by Amy Walter, who will host The Takeaway on Fridays. Amy will be coming to you every Friday with news on politics and the policies that are changing in our country and how they might be impacting you. Tomorrow, Women in Politics, with some of the women running in 2018.
One of the perspectives that is being lost is a conservative woman's voice. I think we do bring a certain cheerfulness with that strength that is one of the things I love about a lot of the women that are currently serving in Congress. We don't think we're victims. We're strong, and we're just there to speak for our families, to speak for our communities, and to speak for, you know, also the men we love.
I'm Tanzina Vega. It's been great talking with you today. This is The Takeaway.